Does the word dulcet get used with any other word than tones?
What does dulcet mean?
Sweet.
Sweet.
Pleasing.
Sweet. Dolce.
Dolce and Gabbana.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Jody Avergan. The government will partially shut down at the end of the week if a budget deal is not reached. President Trump has said that he is willing to shut down the government if the budget doesn't include $5 billion for building a wall at the Mexican border. Democrats have said that they will not support that. And even with control of both chambers, Trump may not have enough Republican votes to get that money for that wall. So we'll discuss later in the show. We're going to talk about power. Late last week, Republican Governor of Wisconsin, Scott Walker, signed a law stripping his Democratic successor of various powers. Some Democrats are arguing it is time for their party to employ similar tactics. They did flirt with such a move in New Jersey recently, then backed off. So we will discuss power and Republicans and Democrats. And here to do that is senior politics writer Claire Malone. Hello, Claire.
Hey, Jody.
Managing editor Micah Cohen. Hello, Micah.
Hello, Jody.
And joining us by Skype is senior writer Perry Bacon Jr. Hello, Perry.
Hello, guys. Good to see you. Or not to see you, but good to be with you.
But we are imagining you talking to us by Skype.
Yes.
Nate out again this week, but we will soldier on. Later in the show, by the way, we're going to have a little fun and play a round of the hit game. People have been really clamoring for it. Guess what Americans think.
But we're doing a new twist on it this week.
Okay, we're going to do a new twist. So listeners, you're going to have to stick around. But let's begin with wall funding, the impending government shutdown. So Perry, I'll start with you. Usually both parties, when we're heading towards a shutdown, really try and avoid blame for the shutdown. But Trump kind of owned the possibility in that meeting with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. So talk through that decision, the political upsides and downsides of Trump's positioning on all this.
I don't think there's a clear... I don't think you ever want to be the person that says, I'm comfortable with a government shutdown and seems like it's your fault. At the same time, and we just had the election, so it's not the political backlash, whatever that may be. There's no sort of real way to suffer that for Trump. And I do think this is the last chance to get the wall, really, because the House is controlled by Republicans. So I think it's totally sort of logical for him to push really hard on the wall right now. I also think for Pelosi and Schumer to push really hard against the wall makes sense since they just won the votes, particularly in the House. So I can see why both sides are really harsh here. And I actually think the chances of a shutdown are fairly high.
Fairly high.
Ooh. Normally we downplay the chance of a shutdown, but you think it's going to happen, Perry?
I don't know how long it'll last. I'm less making a prediction than more saying the dynamics are different than earlier in the year. The Republicans kept saying, Mr. President, don't do a shutdown. That'll hurt us in the midterms. The midterms have happened. They did hurt, you know, and I think now it's going to be hard for him to be convinced that a shutdown isn't like this is what he wants. He kind of wants to do it. You saw Stephen Miller being very adamant yesterday. This is a negotiating ploy. You always want to negotiate hard and not negotiate with yourself. But I think the White House is OK with a shutdown. Mitch McConnell is not that excited about it, but it's hard for him to say this has a big political backlash potential.
I also feel like shutdowns are viewed as less extreme than they used to be. And I think they literally are less extreme. Like if there is a shutdown this time, it'll be a partial shutdown. And
we already had one of those, right?
Right.
We've kind of forgotten about it.
No, but I think agencies can kind of, they have more wiggle room. They can keep more things open. And so it just feels less like, you know, a complete shut off of the government valve.
Yeah. It's also kind of ritualistic now at this point.
Yeah.
It's sort of our national binge and purge sort of thing, and this is our purging time. And I don't think it really makes all that big of a dent on public opinion in the long run. Obviously, we will cite and have talked about how people don't like it, which is natural, because people generally like to think that government works and then they're not taking time off when they should be working. But I think we're pretty dull to its effects, so... gunning for a shutdown, trying to prevent a shutdown. In some ways, it's sound and fury signifying nothing. Now, I know people will get mad at me for saying that, but I'm talking in terms of like long-term political effects. I really don't think it has that much.
Yeah. Like to be clear, people will, if there's a shutdown, people will go without pay for
continuing
a bit
during, with my nothing matters in politics nihilistic theory of things.
No, and politically, that's right. I don't want to be totally insensitive to people, you know, going without a paycheck during the holidays, but yeah, politically, Claire's exactly right. I mean, even the last shutdown, remember, Democrats got a lot of blame for that, and then they went on to have a really good 2018. And if you go back, shutdown by shutdown by shutdown, there's usually like sometimes a severe swing in the polls against the party that's blamed for the shutdown in the short term. But even in the medium term, all that vanishes and reverses itself, and you sort of go back to normal. I mean, I don't know. Shutdowns, like, beyond, is anyone in this podcast actually interested in the shutdown story?
I hope. Well, can I maybe move us beyond the shutdown itself and talk about the
other
thing?
I want to know if people are interested in this.
I mean,
on what level, Micah? What does that mean?
Like, are you interested in this as a story? As
do you know what I'm interested in? The wielding of power and the naked display thereof.
Mm.
Okay, so you are interested in this.
Well, the shutdown is a proxy.
Lightly, I mean, that's why I'm interested in politics.
But wait, can I ask a question now about the wall, which I think is what this shutdown is about?
I'm sorry, I believe it's wall. There's no article.
There's no the wall? It's just wall? Build wall?
I'm making extremely insider joke because they released a press release last week that referred to it as wall.
Oh, really?
Not
wall.
The. Just
wall will be built?
Build wall.
I missed that one. But Claire, how important is wall to Trump's agenda as a priority? And then also, how important is wall to his popularity?
Yeah. I mean, wall is important to base, you know?
So good. Yeah. Right. You got to keep this up. You got to keep this up for the rest of the show.
But I'm not sure how wall plays with swing voter or suburban voter.
Okay, swing voter, no like wall.
Okay, permission to talk normally. Go.
No, I mean, I think it goes to like this. This keeps on going back to, I think we had maybe a Slack chat a couple weeks ago, last week, who knows where the time goes, about like what should Trump do to win in 2020? And we all agreed, like, he should take policy steps to widen his appeal to people beyond his base. Those Republicans who are kind of, like, ideologically there for traditional Republican Party but don't like Trump, blah, blah, blah. But we all kind of came to the conclusion that Trump probably won't do that because he seems to have this mania for kind of monopolicy. And there's only, like, he hits one note. He's, like, playing middle C on the piano.
For a wall.
Perry, do you have a sense of whether passing this funding for the wall is a critical step for Trump's chances?
I actually don't think the wall matters to the base that much. Like, I hated the whole phrase, take him seriously but not literally. But the one thing where that does apply is I don't think Trump's voters are really imagining that wall is going to be built. I think there's some polling where they're not sure the wall will be built. They took the wall as a symbol that he's going to get tough on immigration, and he's done 1,000 things to prove that. So I just think the wall is not even necessary for the base. I just think it's gotten to be like an ego thing. You know, I campaigned on this, and I want it, and I'm the president, and I want it, which is fine. Presidents have done that before.
It's the most visible piece of rhetoric that he has that has to do with immigration. And I thought it was interesting the way Stephen Miller this weekend on the Sunday shows talked about it as this is about protecting our national sovereignty, which I thought was a fascinating way to talk about immigration. I'm not sure it follows logically, but it certainly sounds important. And so, you know, I think it is the rhetoric surrounding the wall is very important to Trump's core message, which is about immigration.
So, yeah, but that's what makes, I think, him, you know, dying on this hill metaphorically, although he probably won't, so weird, because Perry's right that, like, he's done a million things to restrict immigration, legal and illegal. So if you think of the wall metaphorically, Trump has kept that campaign promise. But the wall literally is really unpopular. A CBS News poll, for example, found Democrats obviously hate the wall, right? Only 9% favor it. But 62% of independents oppose the wall versus just a third who favor it. Even among Republicans, only 3 in 4 favor it. So it doesn't even have like overwhelming support among Republicans. So I think it's weird on an issue where Trump has gotten his way on a lot of policies, right, to sort of set up this fight that it doesn't look like he can win. Although, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong about that. Perry, you think he can get this funding? Is that possible?
Yeah, I mean, I think it could pass in the House, and then I think we're talking about 1 billion versus 5 billion, which neither of which, by the way, fund the whole wall. But could he get to 3 billion? I don't, you know, Democrats don't like shutdowns because they're the party of government, so to speak. And so I do think if we get into several days of a shutdown, Schumer and Pelosi, will be looking to get out of it, even if they're sort of winning it, because they don't, you know, Democrats don't like shutdowns. So I think he could get up the number up. So I don't think he's necessarily in. This is not, I mean, if we have a shutdown in the last 3 weeks, it's one thing. But if we're in a 3-day period where he gets from 1.5 to 2.3, you know, maybe that was worth it for him.
Yeah.
This is slightly related, but I mean, we've heard in this argument, this rhetoric from the White House about how Trump's base wants the wall. We've used that phrase a couple of times too. I think it's just worth noting there's this shifting definition of base, it feels like, where it's almost actually sort of circular logic, where it's the people who support the wall are all of a sudden the base, as opposed to the base wants the wall. And the White House seems to be defining down kind of what the notion of their base is. So just to, I think we've kind of answered this, but just to put a circle around it, Micah, like there is not a core base of straight up wall supporters that would then get Trump reelected. He needs to expand beyond how he is currently defining base, right?
Yeah. And you saw that in 2018, where Trump's base was largely with the Republican Party and with Trump, and it was not enough, nor was it particularly close to enough. Even in 2016, right, he lost a popular vote. Trump's base is small.
Can I ask a question? What happens? Let's say Trump gets elected in 2020 again and serves 4 years. 2024 comes around. Will that give enough time for like what we now call Trump's base, who loves Trump because of his personality and the way he approaches politics? Do you think that will still be there in 2024? And, you know, and the Republican Party could find a candidate to kind of carry that momentum through? Or is this base that we're talking about like a really Trump-specific phenomenon?
I'm curious for Perry's answer on this, but mine would be, I think there will be a group of voters who are largely nationalist, have quote unquote conservative views on race / are racist.
Yeah.
And favor isolationist policies.
But do you think that that'll hold? The rest of the Republican Party has kind of like rallied around Trump because it's become it became the momentum of the thing. But do you think in 2024, okay, there's a candidate who appeals to that base, but do you think that they like lose the momentum of all the elected officials, or do you think it carries over? I mean, this is like, I don't know what made me think of that.
I think it'll be, Perry, you should jump in, but I think it'll be smaller in 2024 than it is now, just based on sort of demographic trends. And I think the real question is like, does it shrink by enough to sort of tip over into where it doesn't have plurality control of the Republican Party?
But like plausibly Senator Tom Cotton, you know, President Tom Cotton could like.
Yeah, I don't think that's going away. That's the Republican Party. It was the Republican Party before Trump.
This is kind of the fundamental question is, what is the Republican Party? Is it Trump? Is it Mitch McConnell? Is something in between? I tend to think 80% of the Republicans will vote for who the Republican nominee is, and the 20%, the sort of build the wall group, I think might be smaller than appreciated. In like, if Tom Cotton ran against Nikki Haley, I'd put Nikki Haley as the favorite, but I was wrong before about that. But I do think Trump has a special kind of following and charisma that I don't think applies to the next guy who just has sort of populist immigration views.
So wait, Perry, you think the build the wall group is smaller than the smaller government group?
I think the generic "I vote for Republicans" group is just really big.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Let me point out that we will have lots of opportunities to be wrong about 2024, but we should be wrong about 2020 before we get there.
So
let's just pace ourselves out here. Look, let's move on to our next segment. And Claire, how did you put it before? You said you're interested in power and how politicians wield it.
Yeah, that's the entire reason why I'm even here.
Yeah, great. Well, that sets up our...
I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm not a policy journalist.
Well, look, it sets up our next segment perfectly because we are going to talk about power and how both parties, Democrats and Republicans, wield it. So we're going to do that in a sec. But first, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by GiveWell. Many people want to give to good charities, particularly now around the holidays. But how can you maximize the good you accomplish for each dollar that you give? Well, GiveWell does in-depth, detailed research to identify evidence-backed, cost-effective programs helping the poorest people in the world. On its website, GiveWell.org, you can see a very short list of top charities that have met GiveWell's exacting standards. And GiveWell is unique because it focuses on how much good a charity accomplishes. For instance, how many lives does that charity save, or how much does someone's income increase with each dollar donated? Instead of easier to answer but less important questions, and these are questions that maybe other sites would focus on, like how much does a charity CEO make or how much overhead does it have? Its current top charities at GiveWell do things like fund programs to prevent child deaths from malaria or provide direct cash transfers to very poor households in East Africa. Really important work for your dollars. All the details of GiveWell's work are available for free on its website. You can dive into all the details if you are interested. But if you just have a few minutes, it's also getting towards the end of the year, you want to make some quick decisions, you can just go to GiveWell's top charities and leverage the thousands of hours its staff has put into finding exceptional charities. Make the most of your giving. It takes 2 minutes. Right now, visit GiveWell.org. All right, we're back. And as I mentioned on Friday, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who is weeks away from leaving office, signed a bill limiting early voting and stripping powers from his Democratic successor. This, of course, has been criticized as a power grab by Republicans. There's also another story that maybe didn't get as much attention, but on Saturday, New Jersey Democrats backed off a plan that would essentially enshrine pro-Democratic gerrymandering into law, after they received criticism from good government groups and Democrats themselves. So this gives us a chance to talk about power and how Democrats and Republicans are using it. So let's jump in. And I guess, Perry, I'll give this to you first. Do you think it's fair to characterize Republicans as more willing to use their power in our current political age than Democrats?
I mean, yes. Next question.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah. The answer is clearly yes. Historically, the answer is no.
So when did this start to change?
I mean, I'm not sure exactly when it changed. Maybe, let's say, just for simplicity's sake, with Gingrich in the 90s. Mm-hmm. But the Democratic Party spent decades disenfranchising black voters, non-white voters, which I think falls into this category. But nowadays, clearly, the Republican Party is more willing to fight procedural fights than the Democratic Party.
Democrats also were the political party that started machine politics, which we should remember going all the way back in urban areas.
Yeah, which has a lot of the characteristics of this type of, I don't know, there's not a good way to explain it. It's like f***ing with the gears rather than what goes in the gears or out of the gears.
As I put it, I wrote about core packing, which is one of these things, and I think of it as rat f***ing for institutional change.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's good.
That's the right way to put it. And in terms of the ends here, I'm going to keep asking fairly naive questions here, but in terms of the ends of this rat f***ing of institutional structures, is it really just straight up Republicans prioritize retaining power in a way that Democrats have not? And what's the goal here?
The Republican Party is a more, I think, cohesive demographic group, ideological group, and the Democrats have a lot of internecine struggles and disagreements. And so I think Republicans have been better about deciding on an agenda and kind of sticking to it. There's also something to be said for, in just the classic definition of conservatism, it is about you want to eliminate government to a certain extent, right? So a lot of things you can agree on are, well, we want to get rid of this program and take it to like and let private entities deal with it, or let the market deal with it. Whereas Democrats kind of fight over, well, what program would work best for this? And so there's a lot of things like that. So I think a lot of this also comes down to just the basic ideological concepts of conservatism versus liberalism and the American understanding of it. And it's easier for the Republican Party to come up with a cohesive message and then just kind of raise their focus on it.
Those are both very good answers, I think, because this is a question I've thought about a lot. And I'm not sure there is a sort of one clear answer. But Claire's right that the kind of coalitional nature of the Democratic Party versus the Republican Party seems like it plays a role. Also, I wonder, the Republican Party, at least in the last couple decades, has been a minority party. Mm-hmm. in the country, and so has to turn to, well, doesn't have to, but is confronted with a choice of either sticking to its guns and turning to these types of maneuvers, or changing its message and speakers to appeal to a wider group. But I don't know. I wonder if, like, you know how, you know, there's like the myth of the like great man theory of history, where like it's, you know, when I was in high school, which was a while ago.
Are you going to call yourself the great man of your high school?
No. But I learned about history essentially through great men. I mean, when I was in high school, they started working some women into it. They had not yet gotten around to working, you know, non-white people into it. But I think that, you know, historians now will say, well, that's a largely false, you know, that's a myth, blah, blah, blah. But in this particular case, I do wonder a little bit, like, if Newt Gingrich was just slightly different in terms of his temperament and values, would we have a different landscape today? Or if Mitch McConnell, you know, respected these norms a little more, would things look different today? Or is it actually, as Claire said, the kind of structural things?
But of the Republican Party itself, that like it's easier for someone to take the reins in that way than maybe on the Democratic side? Is that what you're getting at?
I think it's easier to take the reins. But I'm also just saying, like, the Republican Party has this history of screwing around with the machinery of government and elections, because at some point people chose to do that. And I wonder if at a couple critical junctures those people had chosen not to do that, whether it'd be different.
I think in some ways what you're describing is almost like a deist theory of Republican politics, which is to say, like, the clockmaker who makes the clock, i.e. like Newt Gingrich.
Yeah, yeah.
And he is the person who you need to have to like kind of start the thing, but then it kind of rolls off on its own,
yeah,
in
yeah.
some ways. And it would, like, perhaps all the forces just contained within the Republican Party would have transpired and things would have happened, but they needed that kind of set off person at the right place, the right time.
Yeah. Which I don't know if that's right, but I just, yeah. I think about it.
I think in this context we're in right now in Wisconsin, Michigan, North Carolina, I think it looks to me like the Democrats are in the majority. So when you have a governor's vote, the Democrats win slightly. So the Republicans are taking what I would say are kind of counter-majoritarian means. Micah was kind of hinting at that, which is that it's not clear they could win in an environment that was not gerrymandered in this way. And so they want to win. And so they are doing it. If you look at like Medicaid policy, for example, you know, in most states, if you had a referendum on Medicaid and you're seeing this, Medicaid would pass. But if your party is committed to not passing Medicaid, which is popular with the majority of people, then you have to take other means to do that. And why don't the Democrats do it as much? I think it's points in part to the diversity of the Democratic Party. What I would say is, if Democrats systematically looked for how to stop white evangelicals from voting, that would be problematic because they have some whites and some evangelicals in their party themselves who they need votes for. The analogy obviously being Republicans regularly in Wisconsin cutting early voting in Milwaukee look for ways to stop blacks from voting, and there's no backlash from that because they don't need blacks to win an election.
Claire, do you see within the Democratic Party a more of a appetite or a call for them to take on some of these tactics? And then we can get into whether these tactics would work or not.
Yes, there's a great appetite. I would say that there are in the corners of the internet, it used to be magazines, but and I would call it kind of like the thinkfluencer sections of the liberal internet and liberal Twitter. People are very much talking out, writing about a couple of basic institutional changes. I mean, I wrote about court packing, which is one that's really popping up. People have brought up again the idea of, should we expand the number of seats in the House of Representatives? So people are trying to think of ways of, all right, when we get power again, what do we do to change the system? And it's obviously very controversial. And I think without the Trump presidency, Democrats probably wouldn't have talked about it a lot. But I think the Trump presidency has laid bare a lot of, you know, I think interesting gaps in, I don't know, the way we think about, particularly, let's say, the powers that the executive has. A lot of powers of the presidency other presidents didn't use, in part because there were traditions and norms surrounding them. And I would guess that maybe post-Trump presidency, there will be some Democrats pushing for, we need to codify certain things that we once enshrined as norms, but we're not, you know, legally bound to do it for president. Little things like that, where I think Trump has made people game out scenarios within the Constitution that they wouldn't have otherwise thought about. Although we should, of course, note that, you know, FDR dabbled with court packing, and there were different numbers of seats in the Supreme Court at various times in our history. So
I think there are actually two buckets of actions and maneuvers here that get conflated together. I would separate adding justices to the Supreme Court from, for example, making D.C. and Puerto Rico states. Just in the sense that there is a very strong this helps us in a partisan way argument for making D.C. and Puerto Rico states. There is less of a strong argument outside of, hey, this helps our party, for adding a bunch of justices to the Supreme Court.
It's a pro-democratic with a
small
D.
Right, argument. Exactly. Or, you know, making voting easier is something, you know, if I were a Democratic operative, I would be advising them to do. That helps them politically. It's also just like a good thing. People should be able to vote. I don't think that's like, that's a partisan issue, as opposed to, I saw someone suggest breaking California up into six states. That, I think, is a more nakedly, hey, we're just doing this to game the system.
I think the fundamental reason why this is so divisive in Democratic circles is it's a fundamentally attractive proposition for Democrats to increase their power. But then I think when you start to think in the bigger picture, which is basically like, well, what happens if we're essentially creating policies or a national environment that tends to favor, that ends up favoring certain states in certain places in the certain regions of the country, and you start to get into this kind of geographic fractionalization that's disturbing and carries echoes of, oh, I don't know, the Civil War. Even if we don't think that America would ever come to blows again regionally, it doesn't carry great, there's not great historical resonance about dividing up the country based on culture, basically. And I think that that's, when you go from the very attractive short-term or sort of close, you know, your eyes are close to the book kind of thing of, well, the Democrats, I'm a Democrat, I want to gain power next cycle and maintain it for the next few decades. But what are the effects that has on the greater country? You might say, you might believe the ends justifies the means. We will create a greater, more just American society. But you also have to think about or game out, well, how does that, will it rub people in 25 states the wrong way?
Yeah. And do you enter a downward spiral where everybody is just sort of one-upping each other, right? I guess
you could argue that we're maybe already on that spiral. It's just only Democrats are a little slow to realize it or something.
Yeah. I think the next couple of years will be telling in whether we are or not. I guess my point, though, is right now Democrats are asking themselves, do we need to play hardball and start essentially, let's say, violating norms in order to correct some of these imbalances? My point is there is a long list of procedural policies Democrats could push for and enact that would have the effect of correcting some of these imbalances that aren't norm violations. Giving felons the right to vote in Florida, we saw that. Making voting easier, again, you know, letting American citizens in D.C. and Puerto Rico have representation in Congress. There's like a whole range of that stuff that they could do before they even have to decide whether to split California up or add justices to the Supreme Court. So,
Perry, do you see Democrats in a position to take on some of those and moreover sort of understand the distinction that Micah's making between the two kinds of structural changes they could push for?
They do. I mean, I think the challenge that is going to be, you're already seeing some evidence that the Republicans in Florida are not exactly eager to and may create some roadblocks to implementing the felon voting proposal that was passed by the voters. So I do think part of what you're going to see is the Democrats are going to try these procedural sort of polite things and see where they go. And I don't know that they're all going to be actually become law. I think that's a worthwhile question. The second point I would make, and I just don't think Democrats are necessarily there yet. And I'm going to play Nate Silver here briefly to illustrate that. There was a story in the Times a few days ago about New Jersey potentially changing how they do their redistricting. It was very aggressively written. The Democrats are playing hardball, and they're doing. When you get to paragraph like 8 or so, you learn that the Democratic governor of New Jersey opposes the idea. So he's not like Scott Walker. He opposes it. A few paragraphs later, Eric Holder, who's a very influential person, opposes the idea too. You've seen Schumer's been asked about getting rid of the filibuster. He is not excited about that. So far, the norm breaking ideas are at the activist place and very much not supported by Democrats with a lot of power. And so I think that is a core distinction. Maybe the Democrats will get to real norm breaking, but they seem very nervous about it. And their base is sort of sort of the activist part of the Democratic Party is saying, you guys are too naive and too slow. And the party leaders are really not close to there yet.
Although I would also make it, which I think all of that is true, but I would also say that I think that the activist segment of the Democratic Party has gotten more leverage and has gotten louder in the past 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily bet against them. Yeah,
but is there a chance that have Democrats or the Democratic establishment, as you just described it, Perry, have they kind of defined themselves as in opposition to these kinds of naked power grabs? And so then if they begin to take those on or are pushed there by the activist wing of the party, does it potentially backfire because it's undercutting some sort of core way they've defined themselves?
I'm not sure if it's a backfire. I just don't know if they're comfortable with that. If you look at the way Tony Evers in Wisconsin is behaving, he just seems like he's nervous and uncomfortable. Like Scott Walker understands and believes in power and is trying to change it. And I'm not sure Tony Evers is sort of constitutionally able to sort of fight this fight right now. Maybe he will. I have no doubt there are some Democrats that will do this, but I think the party is not. I think it's less about worry about a backlash and more like it's kind of like Democrats. Some of the Democrats are sort of like think they're like nice people and don't view politics in sort of a zero sum way, even though politics often is zero sum.
And that's constitutionally as in his core behavior, not constitutionally.
Yeah, sorry,
constitutionally as in legal by the Wisconsin Constitution, which is another element in this fight as well.
Yeah, it goes back to. I think that's right. I think it's right that Democrats, part of their self-conception, rightly or wrongly, is that they are sort of the fairer party and the more clear, you know, the more like play-by-the-rules party. But I think all of this also goes back to what Claire and Perry mentioned earlier, which is Democrats are the party of government. And so, you know, they want government to work. They believe in government as opposed to, you know, what's the Reagan quote?
Government is not the solution to people's problems. Government is the problem.
Yeah, that one. You know, if you think government is the problem, then I think you're more willing to sort of screw around with it than if you want it to work.
So you just said that Democrats kind of believe in government more and have an understanding of its role a little bit more, which I think we would all generally agree with. But then, you know, going back to something you said earlier about how Republicans have targeted particular centers of power more than Democrats have. Does that show a miscalculation on the part of Democrats to not understand that state houses are really important, judicial appointments are really important, and that they kind of missed the ball over the last 10, 15 years while Republicans said, oh, wow, this is where the real seat of power is, and we're going to go right after that?
I think there's an element of truth to that, both in terms of going after state-level governments and state-level power, and in terms of, like, for example, judicial power. Republicans have seemed more organized and well prepared for a long time, and it's sort of that's a decades long mission on behalf of some Republicans. What I will say, though, just to pour a little cold water on that, is I also wonder how much of it is, you know, when one party holds the White House, the other party tends to make state level gains, and I think for the most part, Republicans made those gains in an era when partisanship was increasing, polarization was increasing, and you saw sort of, you know, the kind of fair play, hey, let's all have a cigar in the back room, some of that stuff break down. So I don't know. I wonder if it's just partly a consequence of Republicans happen to have a few good state level elections in a row and blah, blah, blah.
All right. Well, that's obviously a really interesting conversation. And as Claire mentioned, it underlies basically all of our conversations. But we are going to leave that one there and we're going to move on to end with a fun little game. But first, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by Casper Mattress. With the weather getting colder, the struggle to get out of bed in the morning is real. I can certainly empathize with that. And Casper Mattresses makes it even more tempting to hide under the covers and stay cozy because it is hands down the most comfortable mattress around. Switching to Casper is a no-brainer. It is a high-quality mattress at an affordable price. You will sleep comfortably every night and never wake up overheated thanks to the unique combination of foams that provide the right pressure relief and alignment. Casper ships right to your door for free in a small how-did-they-do-that sized box. They'll even pick it up if you don't love it and refund you everything. From engineering to packaging to letting you try it for 100 nights, it is no wonder that Casper has 35,000 five-star reviews of all their products across Casper, Google, and Amazon. Now is the time to give Casper a try for yourself, or you can give Casper as a gift to someone you care about. That would be a very thoughtful gift, a mattress in a small little box. Head to Casper.com to save 10% on your entire order with any Casper mattress. That's Casper.com. Terms and conditions apply. Today's podcast is also brought to you by WordPress. WordPress powers more than 30% of all websites, from your local favorite coffee shops to the world's biggest companies. You can join a global high-traffic network of organizations and entrepreneurs when you build your website and your business your way on WordPress.com. WordPress allows you to carve out your own little corner of the web, your own little cute little corner of the web with a new custom domain name, or you can use one that you already own. You can create a site that fits you using templates and customizable themes. There is no design experience needed. You're free to import and export your content to and from your WordPress site. It's your website, your home, your content. They will facilitate you using it however you want. You can get your website up and running for just $4 a month. The time to grow your business is now, and you can get 15% off any new plan purchase with WordPress.com/politics. That's WordPress.com/politics. 15% off one more time, WordPress.com/politics. All right, we're back and we're going to wrap up the show with a round of the hit game. If you call it a hit game enough, it just becomes a hit game. Guess what Americans think? This is the 2018 exit poll edition. So I'm going to name a subset of the American population, such as veterans or people with no religious beliefs. And you will have to guess their pro-Republican or pro-Democratic lean in 2018. The caveat here is that this is based on exit poll data, which is, as we all know, not perfect, but it is the data we have in front of us, so no arguing about the answer itself. This is the exit poll data.
Nate's not here.
Yeah, Nate's not here, so we won't get into that. Okay, let's begin with a group, people age 45 and older. So older Americans. Apologies to those of you who are 46 out there for calling you an older American, but age 45 and older, they made up 65% of the electorate. Micah, you start first. Towards which party did they lean in 2018 and by how much?
That's a huge group. I'm going to guess they leaned Republican 53-47.
Okay, 6 points Republican. Claire?
That might be way off.
No, I was going to say six. I'll do Republican plus seven.
Plus seven. And Perry?
I'll do D plus two.
Ooh, D plus two. So this is not Price is Right style, so Perry wins. It was a Republican lean, but only by 1 point.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
I guess all those 46-year-olds.
Yeah, there were just a lot of 46-year-olds.
It is a big group.
It is a big group.
Yeah,
it's a big group.
We were thinking old. We were skewing old.
But maybe let's ask about moving forward. Is that a number? So, you know, I know two of you were surprised by that. But is that a number that you think will continue to hold in 2020? Or is that something that would maybe shift back for later stage Americans, however we want to call them, 45 plus? To be leaning only slightly Republican.
I feel like it's weird to include 45, like to have it be 45 plus. I think like 60 plus or whatever that is, like a pretty clear baby boomer and up kind of group. That to me seems clear that it'll stay probably in a similar place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. 45 plus is a large enough group and a diverse enough group that I wouldn't expect much movement there in 2020.
So let's pick the other end of the spectrum. So people under 45, can we all agree that those people are all incredibly young and have much of their life ahead of them if you're under 45?
They do. Yeah. Now, this podcast is getting pretty ageist.
They made up 35% of the electorate, I will point out. Perry, you won the last round, so to speak. So you want to start here. Where did they lean and by how much?
Under 45. So I'm going to say D plus nine, I guess, something like that.
Okay. Claire?
Now I'm gun shy, so I'm going to say D plus five.
Micah.
D plus 10.
There you go. You played the odds correctly. It's D plus 25.
God damn
people
it.
Under the age of 45
now
lean
that makes
Democratic
sense.
By yeah.
Yeah.
I tried to do the math in my head. Yeah.
So this feels like a big one in terms of thinking, spinning it forward. Are Democrats going to be able to maintain a 25-point margin heading into 2020 for people under 45?
Sure.
Yeah?
Wait, how much of the electorate did they
35% of the electorate? Pretty sizable.
Yeah, I would imagine that this group – well, I don't know actually. I'd push on this one. I don't know that this will get that much more Democratic.
And that margin will be bigger, right? More young people will vote in 2020 than they did in 2018.
So that's what I was going to say is like I wouldn't necessarily bank on the Democratic margin with this group getting bigger, but the group itself as a share of the electorate will get bigger.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. All right, let's move on to the next one. Let's just try and cruise through some of these. So how – Claire, you can start on this one. How did people who live in suburban areas vote?
All people? In suburban areas?
Yes.
D plus 3.
Okay. Micah?
D plus 12.
D plus 12. And Perry?
D plus 8.
Wow. You're all over the place, Micah. It was tied. 49-49.
Ah.
All people in suburban areas, which I think is surprising to me. We've talked so much about how much the suburbs broke.
But it's all people.
But it's all – and not just young people, not just people with a college degree, though those people tend to live in the suburbs, right? Though that's kind of what we've been discussing, how those are tracking closer and closer.
But they're like middle class working.
That's surprising to me.
Yeah, it was 51% of the electorate. Again, this is according to exit polls. Again, I know there's a definition of suburbs, you know.
Yeah.
So, yes. Okay, this one is interesting. And whose turn is it to start with this one? Micah, how did people who have a gun in their household vote? They made up 46% of the electorate, for what it's worth.
That's
what
high.
What percentage?
46%.
Yeah, that's surprising.
I think they voted 61.
Just give us a margin here.
Yeah.
R plus 12.
R plus 12. Perry?
I was going to say something like R plus. I'm going to say something like 70-30. So R plus 40. Maybe I'll be wrong about this. It sounds like I will.
Oh, I like it.
I was going to say R plus 15.
Okay. It's R plus 25.
Okay. So it was a high number, but not super high.
Pretty high number.
Claire got closest.
Yeah. I mean, are we going to see any other?
Hard.
Are we going to see any other splits? I guess we've already seen one split of people under 45. But that's – even this day and age, it's tough to find a R plus 25 or a 25-point margin. But let me just lay out the flip side of this. Those without guns voted for Democrats by a 46-point
margin. All right. So that's kind of what I did have that sense.
That is crazy.
The gun issue was interesting. Yeah.
That How so, sense. Micah?
Because – so what threw me off on that question was the share of the electorate that people with a gun in their house made up, which is 46%.
Welcome to America.
No, well, I know a lot of people have guns, but – well, first of all, that still seems high to me because there are a lot of guns in America, but fewer and fewer people own those guns.
But it's the electorate, which
it's the electorate. That's a good point. But anyway, I thought, oh, that is a high enough share of the electorate that it can't be that – lopsided one way or the other,
right?
But I think what you see there is just we're incredibly polarized as a country, and whether there's a gun in your house is like a pretty – probably one of the better predictors of whether you're a Republican or a Democrat.
Let's move on and let's try and squeeze in a couple more, and I'll update the score as it stands now. Claire is in the lead, 2-1-1. Perry, you can start on this one. How did Latinos vote? In what direction and by how much?
This is probably we should move on. I did a piece about this.
Oh. Hey, the question's the question. Well, do you remember the stat in your own piece is the question.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I think it was 71-29 in the exit polls and like 74-24 according to Latino decisions. Either way, Micah and I have some advantage because we just were writing about this.
Okay, yes, it's true. It's 40 points, so we'll scrap that one.
For the record, I wouldn't have admitted to it. I would have taken the advantage.
Oh, look at you. Perry, here's one. How did white college graduates vote? They made up 31% of the electorate.
See, this is the one I have trouble with. I'm going to say Democrats, white college graduates. I'm going to say Democrats plus 4, but I'm always wrong about this.
Claire?
D plus, no, split, even.
Ooh.
See, I have to do, I have to play the Price is Right strategy. D plus 5.
Okay. Now, before I give away the answer, Claire, why split even? We've talked so much on this show about college education being a big factor in this country.
Well, we've talked a lot about white women, college-educated women being swing voters more and more, and women in general. But I'm just factoring in white men.
Yeah. So it's Democrat 8 points, 8 point eight. Margin.
Okay.
So
Micah wins.
That's the important thing there. Whites without a college degree, by the way, made up 41% of the electorate and voted for Republicans by 24-point margin, which I think is kind of in line with what we've discussed, but it's still pretty startling.
This game is really making me love that the data journalism is an open book test.
Mm-hmm.
That we always
no, it's hard.
You can go look it up.
But it, that white with a college degree, how many? What was their share of the electorate?
31% of the electorate voted for Democrats by eight.
That's interesting.
And then spinning it forward, I mean, how important will this demographic be for the future of the Democratic and the Republican parties?
Very. I'm going to predict D plus 11 in 2020.
It's going to increase that split. Okay. Well, listeners, mark this moment. Write it down. Podcast won't exist in 2020. It's a bubble. It's going away. But nevertheless, there is your prediction. All podcasts.
Yeah.
Okay. Last one. How did people... This is a little esoteric here, but how did people with an unfavorable view of Nancy Pelosi vote in 2018?
Oh, I like
D
this
plus,
one.
I mean, R plus a gazillion.
A gazillion is the actual answer. Perry?
With an unfavorable view of Nancy Pelosi. So I assume some people have no opinion at all, which is why I'm a little bit, this question has some, I'd be curious what the numbers were. Let's say R plus.
Actually, I know that 20% of people didn't have an opinion.
Those are the people I want to spend the holidays with.
So that's so I'm going to say R plus 50 can be wrong, but yeah, R plus 50. I don't know.
R plus 50. Okay. And?
Some Democrats don't like her either.
Wait, what was, Claire has to give a real answer.
You go first. Don't
no,
bully
it wasn't
me.
My turn. It was you. You have to go.
I don't remember whose turn it is. I'm not the official of the official.
Micah,
of the game,
you go, and then Claire's
going
to go. Perry says R 50.
I'm going to say R plus 41.
Okay, and Claire?
I'm going to say R plus 25.
Okay, it's R plus 51. People who don't like Nancy Pelosi. Were you going a little lower because you thought of Democrats who
Democrats
didn't like Nancy
like
Pelosi?
Her.
Yeah, that's true.
Perry was one off.
Maybe not that big of a group. Yeah, Perry was right there. So I think rough math. Perry wins.
Wait, isn't it 2-2-2?
I think I only got two because Latino word doesn't count because I...
Well, we all win.
Everyone wins.
Are we a bunch
no,
of
No, we need a tiebreaker.
Let's do a tiebreaker, of course.
Okay, we're going to do a tiebreaker because it's 2-2-2. How did Protestants vote?
Okay, Protestants. So that's not just evangelicals, that's Protestants. I'm going to say R plus 15.
Claire?
I'm going to say... A lot of black voters are Protestant.
Right, exactly.
So are a lot of white people.
just talk it out.
This is a hard one. That's why I had to think about it. Yeah.
R plus two.
Two?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Jeez. R plus eight.
Okay, it's R plus 23.
Jeez.
So Perry wins.
Perry wins.
As I said, Perry wins. Okay, thanks for playing.
Because, you know, there are a lot of black Protestants, but it's just way bigger. Yeah.
All right. Well, that was fun and hopefully informative. And maybe we'll put some of these numbers on our – I mean, they're all on our site. Some of them are in Perry's.
We should make it a quiz for the site and let people take it.
And then if you've listened to the podcast, you will get it right.
Well, we could do different.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, we should make this a quiz. Okay, that brings us to the end of the show. And before I say goodbye to our crew, I also want to say goodbye to you, dear listener. This is a bit of an announcement, but I am soon going to be leaving the 538 Politics podcast. This is basically my last show. We're pre-recording something this week that's going to run a week from today on Christmas Eve. And then I will no longer be hosting the show. Galen Druk will be taking over, and I want to thank him along with all the folks here who have made this show really fun over the years. I've been juggling a lot. The 30 for 30 podcast is really sort of off and running. I have a kid. So going into 2020 and that election.
Excuses.
I just, the balance was not going to be there. So I'm going to leave and I'm going to focus on some other stuff. I already have a few other things up my sleeve. But I just want to say this has been really fun to do this for the last few years. From diners in New Hampshire to live shows to the documentaries we've done. It's been a blast.
Well, as the official spokesperson for 538, Jody, thank you for everything. You helped build this podcast into what it is today. And I mean that as both a compliment and a curse. but no, really, thank you.
I appreciate it. And listeners, you should just know that if you have complaints about the music or whatever, it's not my problem anymore. You can reach out to someone else.
Galen, send them to Galen now.
But if you do want to stay in touch with me, the best bet is maybe just go to my website, jodyavergan.com, or I'm on Twitter. I have a newsletter, but you can just sort of, let's stay in touch. This has been truly, really fun.
Can I add as an outside? Sorry, Jody. As somebody who, you know, came on later, I was listening to the podcast before I worked here. I went to a live event before I worked here. I think you've done a really terrific job. Like, you do a great job of, like, bringing kind of nerddom and the eccentric behaviors of, you know, Harry and Nate and I and Claire. I think you've done a really great job harnessing that to a really great podcast. I meet people all over who tell me they listen to the podcast, they love the podcast, and they particularly love you and what you do in the podcast. So I just want to emphasize that.
Well, I appreciate that. And I mean, I'll add one more thing, which is I've often said and felt like my main role has been as like number one listener. I kind of get to hear all this great analysis and sit with these people before our listeners do by a couple hours. And so that's been the best part of this, is just to sit here and kind of hear all you smart people talk about politics each week.
Are you going to keep listening?
We'll see. I may leave a rating or a review every once in a while. Okay, we're going to leave it there. Thank you to you, Claire.
Thanks, Jody.
Thanks to you, Micah.
Thank you, Jody.
Thanks to you, Perry.
Thanks, and congratulations to Jody.
Thanks. My name is Jody Avergan. Galen Druk is our producer. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us, podcast@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments about the show. Again, we are pre-recording this week, but we will be in your podcast feed next week. That will be my final show, and then we're on from there. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.